Hello, everyone. Rob here in the Bunker Studio. I have a bug up my ass again. This will probably come as no surprise to regular listeners. As you guys know, I've been working full time on police reform, advocacy, and policy and engagement. And the closer you get to this stuff, the worse it is. Last week, we talked about incidents in Newcastle County and the Newcastle County Police Accountability Board and the meeting that they had. We reviewed that with Medina, who was there. If you haven't listened to that one, you should definitely go back and take a listen. This week, we're going to talk about other police accountability boards and other police issues in Kent and Sussex County. We have Ty Greer going to be joining us. And talking about an incident in Dover, and we'll talk about sort of how the police are sort of playing with this idea of police accountability boards and why everybody should be on the lookout. But before we do that, I wanted to read a little passage. I was telling folks that, you know, I just finished my second time through of the historical novel Cloud Splitter by Russell Banks. It's a historical novel about the life of John Brown. And I was going over my notes, and I came across a passage that sort of built upon a quote that Medina read on last week's show from the independent journalist I.F. Stone about the fights worth fighting are the ones you know you're going to lose, because somebody has to be sort of at the forefront so that 100 years from now somebody wins. And, you know, it... It seems crazy, but it's the truth. That's sort of how these things work. And I came across this passage, and I just wanted to read it to you. So, near the end of the novel, the narrator, who is John Brown's son, Owen, is sort of sitting in a tree outside of Harper's Ferry and watching things transpire. The novel is, again, fiction. So one of the devices that Banks uses is to insert Owen, who was John Brown's son, into stories to sort of describe them. For example, John Brown did go to England in order to try to sell some merino wool and fleeces to English traders and business people. It was kind of a failure. Famously, he also, while he was in Europe, did do some tours on mainland Europe and study Napoleon and study other sort of military tactics. But famously, Owen was not there. But in the novel, Owen is there to be able to sort of describe what happened. So it's the same for the Harper's Ferry raid. The facts about it are accurate, but they're told through a literary device. And so this is Owen... explaining that during the night of the first of the raid, during the first night of the raid, there's a scuffle when a sentry sort of comes to a bridge to sort of relieve the person who was the guard there, and a shot or two is fired, and it sort of gives them away. Obviously, once the guns start going off, but this is what Owen has to say about that moment. This is an eventuality that Father has anticipated, a part of his overall plan. And so long as it happens after the bridges and the arms stores have been captured and hostages have been taken, it does not much concern him that sometime in the night a shot or two will be fired, alerting the citizens that a violent action is underway. By daylight they'll know of it anyhow, and will be told by him then of its purpose, and soon the whole country will begin to apprehend its scale. After all, this raid is meant to be a public act, not a private one, he has reminded us. And if our aims are to be met, we must actually invite a certain hue and cry. And so long as we are in control of events and not they us, welcome it.
Oh, baby, it's not possible to leave it alive, to leave it alive.
In the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, from the belly of the Delaware Way Beast, this is Rob. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. Hello. Today we have a special guest returning. For new listeners, this is a combination we like to call Jerkyville. We're here with our friend and comrade from Kent County, Ty Greer. Hello, Ty.
Hello, hello. It's just so good to be back in Jerkyville.
How you been?
Oh, I've been busy.
I can imagine. It's funny, you sent me that text this morning and you were like, well, I'm a little low energy today. And I'm like, between the two of us, our low energy is probably higher than most people's high energy. So I think people can deal with that.
You're right. I keep forgetting that.
So the reason for my call yesterday to talk was that this article came out, and I'm just going to read the first couple of paragraphs to give people a feeling for it, and then we're going to talk about the incident. I hate to do this again, but Esteban Parra wrote this story. It looks like, well, we'll just get into it. Two injured, including officer, after Dover police rifle is discharged during arrest. Did it discharge itself? Who's to say? Who's really to say? Two people, including an officer, were injured Monday when a Dover police officer's rifle was discharged during an arrest. That's a funny usage of the verb discharge. So it was just discharged. The second paragraph. The officer, a 2.5-year member of the Dover Police Department, so I know 2.5, it's written as 2.5 on Delaware Online, that must come right from a police press release, because no reporter would put 2.5, they would say 2.5-year member. So I'm sorry, Esteban, I'm just pointing it out. Sorry, buddy. And a 22-year-old Smyrna man who was arrested and treated for injuries to their hands. The officer has been released from the hospital, blah, blah, blah. Here, the next part is even better. This is where we want to get into it. So what happened? The incident begins around 20 past 2 p.m. Monday as members of Dover Police's Special Operations Response Team. Now, anytime I see any police unit with a name like Special Response Team, I know it's fucked up. I mean, that's the first thing, is if people followed the call stuff last year and the stuff we talked about Operation Safe Streets, when they jump out on people for parole, or like these units that do jump outs or have done them, the Governor's Task Force, anything called that, you know, it's already bad. So what happens is this group gets a tip, and it always just says, oh, a tip, which again is probably like people settling scores on the street and like ratting out their friends or whatever. They get a tip, they roll up to this guy in the parking lot of like a hotel or something. He's sleeping in his car, and they surround him. I guess he tries to drive away, and in the process of trying to like stop his car and get him out of the car, they're trying to break the window, and a rifle goes off. Now, I assume they were trying to break the window with the butt of a long gun. It doesn't really say, but that's kind of what it is. The rifle goes off. People are hurt. They finally do arrest the guy for 8 ounces of weed, which, hey, Good for you. It's very legal now, and a loaded handgun, which I think is also legal as far as I know in the United States. But hey, they got him. They really got him. So yeah, Ty, do you know anything about this incident? Have you heard anything about this incident? And is there anything going on in the community, sort of as a response to this?
So far, honestly, so far, not really much has been. I think it was because of the timing, actually. I'm going to be honest with you, because this incident happened. And then, you know, like, then the Sonya Massey thing happened. So I think it was just like the timing. But this has really not been much movement on this yet. Like, there have been phone calls made, meetings scheduled, but there hasn't been like much, like, there really hasn't been much movement on this.
Yeah, it's interesting because as people know, one of the things I've been doing is like tracking the police accountability boards that have been popping up, seeing who's being compliant with 205 and 206, who isn't, how they're going to work, and things. And we've talked a lot about the Newcastle County Police Accountability Board because it was stood up based on an ordinance from the council. It was driven by the executive, and they set up a fairly large, diverse board with the two police are just ex officio. They're not voting members. They can't sit in on executive session, et cetera, et cetera. But that was at the behest of the executive administration, Matt Meyer, in this case, in Newcastle. Now, my understanding is that a few folks, one of my colleagues from ODS, Tom Donovan, one of our comrades, Vonda Smack from the ACLU, who lives in Dover, went to discuss the potential of a police accountability board in Dover. They have some, I guess they have like a police chief's advisory board, and they're just gonna roll with it and just be like, we're gonna put cops on it, and whoever's on the police athletic league, and they're gonna be the police accountability board. And so the pushback was like, hey, you know, in Newcastle County, they did this ordinance and they set it up, you know, in a very robust way. And they have the police chief and mayor in Dover have no appetite to do that. And when they say that it's at the sort of discretion of the mayor, I think, I'd have to have somebody, an expert, sort of read the statute again for me. But I think that they're right. I think that the mayor or the executive of Newcastle County or the mayors of other these other municipalities can kind of do whatever they want. And so I don't think the PAB in Dover is going to be any good. I would have hoped that something was stood up so that an issue like this had a way to be sort of discussed in public, but I guess that's, you know, probably not going to happen everywhere. What's your understanding? Do you know? I know you lived in Dover. You don't anymore, but I know that you are pretty much clued into all things Kent County. Is that how you sort of see the Dover board? Is this going to be sort of another nothing where there's going to be no way for the community to go and sort of like, have their grievances heard?
So I don't know if it's by the lawyer's advice or union advice or whatever, but we have a hard enough time being able to get our answers, our questions answered in regular city council meetings, or if we have they call a council meeting, a special meeting, and the police chief doesn't come, you know. So I don't know that I really honestly can't see. If I got to pick my own police accountability board and I was the chief of police or the mayor and the mayor's over the chief of police, I'm not going to pick people who are going to hold me accountable. I'm going to pick people who are going to go along with what I want. You're going to have my back. So short answer is I can't see it at the way it's currently. If it's at their discretion, I can't see it being anything that we would expect the legislation to have made it, put it that way.
Yeah, they're going to set up, they're going to take pains to do literally the bare minimum. And they're going to do the bare minimum, I think, as you said, with people that they already know, that they can just sort of like, that they're going to have their back, basically. I think that's right. I wonder, my whole shtick has been like, okay, the Newcastle County Police Accountability Board is good. I mean, good in this, it's relative, right? It's like, it's the best it can be. You know, we've talked about how, you know, real power, it doesn't really have any power, but it has a diverse group and a motivated group of people to facilitate stuff in the community. Again, that's probably the best they can do. They can make reports, they can make recommendations, but it's all public, so that's the best they can do. And that can be sort of a model for other communities. Because I wonder, you know, in Newcastle County, we had an incident at Royal Farms with a beating that we've talked about. We had an incident with some kids getting, set upon by cops for jaywalking, apparently. But the body cam footage is out. The Police Accountability Board has a public open meeting. That's out. And so I wonder, like, if I'm a If I'm a Dover resident and I'm like, well, you know, at least if something happens in Newcastle County, they'll try to get to the bottom of it. And people in Dover are like, yeah, we're going to get to the bottom of it the way we do it. Like, so we'll let you know, like what happened and that's it. And so I wonder whether that's going to start to create a friction, you know, within the community in the state is like, well, you know, why does one area get, you know, get a police accountability board that's as robust as it could be, and others get either nothing or the bare minimum? You know, I don't know how that's going to go over, you know.
Well, I think part of the problem is in Newcastle County, like, they can keep things, like, they can't keep things hush-hush. I think part of it is in Kent County, they're so used to hearing, we don't do that here, or we can't do that here, that they kind of like accept it. And when I tell you, there are so many incidents that go on with Dover police that never make the paper. You just hear them from people in the community, or we hear them when they want to make complaints. That if people even knew, and this is why we need this public, you know, account of police accountability boards, if they knew how many things were going on that are not being made public, I think that they would care more. So the short answer is, when you talk about County Executive Matt Myers, he's able to do that on the county level, right? We don't even have that same equivalent position in King County. We only have the levy court, right?
Yeah.
We don't have a county exec who is putting money into our communities, who is out here, you know, making sure that X, Y, and Z happens, who is visible in the community. We don't even have that. So at least people in Newcastle County, they know that when something happens with the police, that they know he's an option, right? They know that they could go to him. That he has been good on things in the past, some things, right?
Mm-hmm.
They know this. We don't have that equivalent in Kent County. And I think that's part of the breakdown. So it's almost like when you're looking at things down here, there's so many things that have to be brought up to speed to even get to that point. So what happens is, being the majority of the people don't know what options we have as a community, they keep recycling the same people. It's the same 10, 15 people in every freaking board, every committee, every everything. So are you really getting diversity, or are you getting people who are padding their political resumes?
Yeah, and I feel like they approach things in such a way that they're like, well, yeah, everything they have to bury it, hide it, marginalize it. Like it's nothing. Don't worry about it. It was one thing, you know. Of course, yeah. The Chucklehead brothers, you know, tried to break a guy's window and a rifle went off. But don't worry about it. We'll retrain. You know, we'll do this. And you know, it's kind of an insult. I feel insulted, and I feel like that's sort of like, I don't know. I know you agree with this, but I guess maybe we'll just be a talking point. Like, obviously, people don't feel comfortable fighting this because it's the same 12 people. It's the people with power. They don't really have to do anything. But what it proves is that you don't have a good partner, a good faith partner. You know, it's not like everybody kind of wants to, like, you know, not stick their head out above the parapet, because they know that, you know, there's no working with you know, if they're going to tell you that they're not going to release body cam footage because they don't have to, or they're not going to release, you know, information about it, they don't have to, they're not, you know, and so if they're, you know, that's not a good faith partner, and I think that needs to be that needs to be hammered home. You know, I hesitate to say it, but it's part of the discourse and it's part of the sort of media landscape. So I will say it. You know, the News Journal has a reporter, Isabel Hughes, who's written numerous just glowing stories about profiles of the police, talking to the police chief. You know, talking about how, you know, the community needs to be cleaned up, showing pictures of, like, drug bags at that famous move where you take pictures of like drug stuff in a park, like that's not helping. Like the institution of the police don't need any more propaganda. Like they already have everything. They already are able to tell advocates when they come in to just, you know, here's your hat, there's the door, we're not doing it because we don't have to do it. So what other support do they need? What they need is to be challenged, to be made to look ridiculous and stupid because they're violent, and we need to start looking at the places where they are being challenged in some fashion and use that as a model, because I don't think that's sort of sinking in. You mentioned it yourself. People are sort of just, they're conditioned to hear like, hey, we don't do that here, sorry, and then they're just like, they don't know what to do. And I hope... I'm sorry?
And then that's the end of it. Like, they literally just like, oh, and then just like, oh, well, you know, I tried, and then they said no. And, like, so, like, what's your next step? But I think it's really important to point out that when we have the same people always sitting at the table, right? And this is I'm telling you, this is the Delaware Way problem. Every year I feel like I know more about the Delaware Way than I did the year before. When you have the same people sitting at the table, the same people going out to dinner, the same people who are, you know, building relationships and going to each other's houses for recreational things, right? Can they really hold each other accountable? And the answer is no. And the reason why I say the answer is no, because we're watching it happen. All they have to do is go and smooth one or two people who are leaders for whatever organization, right? And then it falls silent. And we're watching it happen, whether it be religious leaders, whether it be community leaders, whatever. It's the same people at every table, but then things are not happening. So at that point, we have to start to understand that if it's the same leaders at every table and things are not getting, there's no progress, or we're just going along with minimal progress and minimal things, then our problem is our leadership, right? Our problem is that we need more people in leadership. We need new, fresh ideas. We need people who are not afraid to challenge stuff. But the problem is, if we have everybody who's being mentored by the last group of leaders, right? So then it's not, and I'm not blaming them. It's because, hey, I got this way because such and such opened the door for me, right? So now they're indebted to them. So they don't want to do anything to ruffle that person's feathers, right? And then I might want to run for office, so I can't do anything against this person's, say anything about this person's bill or this person's actions, because I need their vote and their support. And then, you know, I'm about to buy a house and my favorite realtor's best friends, like the Delaware Way. The short answer is the Delaware Way is the reason why things are not changing. It literally is. And we talk about it all the time. And advocates talk about it all the time. Community leaders talk about it all the time. And then they turn around and perpetuate it right after they talk about it.
Yeah, that's the most frustrating thing is, and I mean, one of the reasons I do this sort of independent media stuff is to give people a place to like call bullshit. Because that's the problem, is that, you know, you're mentored by somebody, you get this position, and it's just like, well, I have a seat at the table, so I need to sort of play by the same etiquette now that they have allowed me to sit at the table, and all of a sudden you're completely co-opted. Because you're not, you have to make a challenge, you have to use that to try to make a challenge, because otherwise everything you said, I look at it like, And I guess powerful people just feel like it doesn't really matter. But I look like, was this, do you know whether or not this incident happened in Carrie Harris's district? Is that her district?
I do not know if it happened in her district. But
I'm going to use her as an example because she's in leadership in the House, and so she has to, you know, she's going to have to just take it. You know, here we have somebody who was an insurgent candidate. You know, that's how she kind of burst on the scene from the working class, and really made a name for herself um, as a as an activist, as a human rights activist, and now is just totally impotent, just like a fucking wet noodle. And nobody really points it out. Like,
I'm gonna challenge that one. Okay, only reason I'm gonna challenge it is is because King County is totally different. Okay, so when you're talking about the King County legislators, let's just take Kerry off the scene. Let's talk about Sean Lynch. Yep. Let's talk about Bill Bush. Let's talk about Carson. Right. Kerry was the last one to come on the scene, right? But when she came onto the scene with a whole bunch of complacency, right? There is nobody else. Sean Lynn works in this industry, right? So why should he have less responsibility than Kerry?
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Because he's literally benefiting. I don't want to say benefiting from crime, but he is, right? So why should he have less responsibility than Kerry? Now, Kerry's in leadership, right? But she just got to leadership. And I'm not saying that she shouldn't have responsibility. I don't even know if this happened in her district. I honestly don't even know if she knows that it happened. You know, I haven't talked to her about it. But what I'm saying is that I don't think that Kerry, in my opinion, maybe you might have seen it differently. I don't think that she came out championing for police reform and all that other stuff, right?
No. And that's fair. That's fair. I think the reason is that, like, the people you mentioned, yes, Sean Lynn is, a Democrat and an attorney. He has been in the House long enough for me to realize that he's just sort of like, he is what he is. You know, he's very good in, like, committee hearings. He did a very good job at cross-examining a witness during the 313 corporate law changes. And I know that he's also, you know, helped out with the death penalty stuff. He's pretty good. But he is what he is. You know, Kerry, again, not that she was the champion of, like, police reform and why didn't you do something, but she was somebody who would speak out for the people, the working class, she was an activist who did not have any problem threatening powerful institutions when it helped, you know, it helped her political career. Now, Bill Bush has sucked from the beginning. Lumpy Carson has sucked from the beginning. I have no expectations of them. They never indicated to me that they were. Do you know what I mean?
The thing is, I think that, and the only reason I'm going to push back on this is that I'm so sick and tired of when Black women get into positions that it always falls on us. Right. And I know that you don't mean it like this, but it always falls on us. It's like when we get into a position of power, people automatically expect us to just save the freaking world, you know? And so I'm saying this as a Black woman, like when you have all these white males who were here before us, right? You know that Kerry comes in there, trails a blazing, Kerry will not get reelected, right? We know this. We know that she's not going to get support from her Kent County comrades because they're not doing anything, right? So it's like almost like, what do we do? And I'm talking about us as a community to make these people feel like they have the support that they need to go in and challenge things. The reason why people don't challenge things, I believe, is because they know it'll be political suicide. Look how they do Medina. Look how they do Medina. So when you're in Medina, and I'm only using Medina as an example because Medina, but even on the corporate bill, the LLC vote, you know, she got backed into a corner with that. We have to figure out how we as a community, we cannot keep putting our votes on people and expecting them to go in there because at the end of the day, Kerry, Medina, anybody that we name, they only have one vote. So the problem isn't them by themselves. The problem is the whole group as a collective, right? Because we have lots of people who ran on Leobor. We have lots of people who literally, that was their challenge. Now, in Kent County, when we're talking about, like, we have Kerry, we have, we know we're not expecting nothing from Yurt, you know.
Right.
We're not expecting. Again, we have zero expectations.
That's kind of what I was saying, too. It's like, I take your point, and I'll let you finish, too. But I will say, and I'll continue once you're done. There is a greater expectation on certain people, from me even. But I don't. But I think that that's. I think it's fair to say that there's.
But why is it always black women?
Well, here's what I'll tell you. It's a fair point. Here's the other issue. I'll say, and this is a black man, but in any event, you tell me whether this makes sense. And I'm not gonna talk about like specifics of what we talked about, but I had a long conversation with Eugene after he withdrew from the House race, and part of the conversation was that, yeah, I understand why you would be a little bit disappointed because you feel like the standard was higher, the expectation was higher, and you had to meet, like, we were looking for you to meet a standard, not have, you know, fundraisers with Republicans. And I understand that. Like, I don't know whether that's fair necessarily, but that's just how it is, and it's because your career and your political sort of identity has been built up with the force of activists and advocates on the left. Organizations on the left, media that we created by you going out and putting yourself on the line for issues and being an activist. So like sort of Carrie and Eugene are sort of the same in that fashion. And then you get to the spot where you're actually going to be, you're going to represent people and have actually hold political power, and you don't do it anymore.
So I can appreciate that, but let me just give you an example. For example, we have people who were support Sarah McBride, right? But then when it came to Eugene, it was like, oh, Eugene didn't do this. Eugene didn't do that. Eugene didn't do this. But Sarah's a champion for X, Y, and Z. Sarah didn't do the exact same things that Eugene didn't do, right?
Right.
So him as a black male, who's going to have a 10 times harder challenge, even running that same race, he's going to have a harder challenge. We're putting more onus on him. So we're willing to support her because, well, we don't expect her to do nothing.
Well, in my defense, I've been very clear about this. I did tell Eugene this too. I don't support, I'm not voting for Sarah. Number one, she doesn't need my vote. She didn't before, she doesn't now, and it's fine. She was my state senator, and she was a fine state senator. She did constituent services. We have an open line of communication, and that's fine. But you're right, and I will say this, that I guess that's my point, is like, I was never voting for Sarah, so it doesn't, like, that part of it is just sort of out of it. I was looking for an alternative. And obviously, based on my politics and the way that I think and all of that, this is what I wanted, an alternative. And I certainly thought, based on past sort of work and him being a close friend of mine, that he would be a good alternative. And he wasn't. And so, you are correct that I think a lot of people just say, well, I'll just go with this anyway. That wasn't really my angle. I mean, but the point's still well taken. Like, you know, is it fair? Probably not.
So how would, for example, I'm just going to throw it out here, right? How would Eugene, from his constituency and the people that he knows, like, he has to run, he has to raise money to even be considered in this race. This is a federal, this is not local. To even be a consideration, to be taken seriously, he has to raise X amount of dollars. Is that possible? Do you think that he could do that 20, $50 donations at a time? Meaning he's only known in Wilmington, right? Eugene is not really known throughout the whole state, right? So I think part of this is, and I just want to just throw this out here, not just for Eugene, but for every candidate. Like, we keep wanting people to run for office, and I've had people ask me to run for office, right? I've asked people for me to run for office, but I know within my circle of people, I mean, I'm going to have people who are going to support me, but if we got 20 other people who are running, I don't have the financial bandwidth, right, My circle doesn't have the money, so I would have to go outside of my circle and reach out to them, and that's part of the problem. So I guess what I'm saying is that we keep putting people of color into these positions, and we want them to take charge, right? I, for one, am one who I donate to Medina's campaign every month, right? But what are we doing to make sure that they have the financial backing and community support to make sure that when they take the helm that they can do these things?
Well, I think Medina's a good example because, as you said, she gets marginalized, she gets beat up, she gets insulted with signs around her neighborhood, but she is a runaway winner every, you know, she was a runaway winner again the last election. I guess here's what I'll say. I think it's contextual, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. In the Eugene case, it's very difficult because you have a politician who has kind of locked up a bunch of different sort of revenue streams, if you want to call it. That's what they are. And so you are correct. Sort of formulated was you could go kind of two different ways about that. I mean, you're running against a very powerful, savvy politician. And so you could do one of two things, I think. You could, because you're running for the U.S. House, sort of say, I'm running to be, you know, Jamal Bowman just got his ass kicked, but he got redistricted. But he tried. It wasn't really his fault. It was a different reason. But you could say I'm going to basically buttress and support the squad. I'm going to be a Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, you know, and I'm going to support that agenda. Yeah, that agenda. So the sort of the Premiya Jayapal agenda, that sort of progressive democratic socialist agenda. And that separates you from a centrist like Sarah. Or, and I think that there's money to be had there. I think people like the idea of somebody going and supporting this group. You know, anytime Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib or Summer Lee get a challenge, the whole country that thinks as we do backs them up. And so you could do it that way. You could be the Summer Lee of Delaware, whatever. Or you could go and try to get money from the reactionary Democrats and Republicans and get your money that way. Because I do agree, you need to have the money in a federal race to get the message out. Completely agree. There's a couple different ways to do that. Also, you picked a race against, like, you know, the person who's going to just snap her fingers and money's going to appear.
And that's where I was going to go with this. Okay, so my thing is not necessarily why would you pick this seat of all seats, right? When we had 8 million seats available, why would you pick this seat to run against her, knowing that it would have to cause you to compromise your morals maybe, or compromise like your ethics? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you would have to get money from different sources running against Sarah. We know Sarah's money is going to just drop in her. It's just gonna drop into her wallet, like her, you know, her egg blue is just gonna be dinging all day long. And then you know the constituency that you lean towards may not have the finances that don't have the finances when you have national donors and organizations that are just waiting to dump money into her account, right? I guess my next question is, my next statement is going to be that I think that sometimes people get blinded by power or the proximity to power or the idea of power, and what they're doing may not be as strategic. I'm a firm believer that everybody deserves a challenge, right? But if we're talking about what was best for the ecosystem, I mean, crazy enough, if you listen to people in King County, they think that Sarah is a progressive champion, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously she's a, well, for a certain kind of person who's not really, sort of dialed into it, you would think that.
And but that's the majority of people are not dialed into it. And I think that that's the part that we as like activists and community organizers and stuff have to understand, that a lot of times when people want to go run on these progressive agendas, or they want to go run on, you have to do the groundwork first. Like, you have to be in your community, and you have to get your community, because the community does not know. They don't know people's voting records. They only know when it's something that a big deal comes out about it, right? Then maybe, you know, a 10% of the community knows, but they don't know. So when you go, when Sarah, by her doing the paid family medical leave, of course, we have a pocket of people who can't stand that legislation, but the majority of people in Delaware, this is positive legislation, right? That alone to her, especially since we have different organizations like the NAACP, where it's part of their national, now it's part of the national agenda, is paid family medical leave. And here she championed it, you know, before we even got it on the federal level. When you have, like, if you don't let people know what you're doing before you do it, or educate people, and I guess that's what I'm saying, we need more education in the community. Like, we need, a lot of times we want to do these one issue campaigns, and I get it, and we want to just focus on one policy for a whole, you know, general assembly. But I think that we have to do more as far as education. Like, we have to educate people way sooner, because how can you make, even if, throw Kamala out there. Like, if I, the things I read in people's comments on this debate about Kamala and Trump is mind blowing to me. Okay. And it goes to show, like, how uneducated most voters are when it comes time to push their little button, right? So when we talk about people, like,
can you give me an example? Can you give me like an example? I mean, I kind of know what you're talking about, but I want to know. I kind of like exactly what you mean.
So, for example, I see a lot of times when people bring up Kamala's, you know, her record as a prosecutor, right? And then I've been thinking to myself, like, some of these people are young. Do you remember what was happening in California in that time frame? Like, people wanted to be tough on crime throughout the country. Remember, we were having gang wars. Drugs were everywhere, right? Kids were getting killed in crossfires. Like, it was horrible. I'm not saying that I agree, disagree, or whatever, but let's just say, boom, that was X amount of years ago. What are our options right now, right? Why aren't we knew Biden was old when we elected him the first time, right? He was on his final leg. We had 4 years for somebody to be out here hitting the streets, for they're here pushing an agenda, for to get somebody ready, right? But the reason why so many people are now disenfranchised is because we keep getting two choices where people feel like they're choosing from the lesser of two evils.
I look at things like this. I have Biden was bad. Harris is better. I assume that she'll her administration would be similar to Biden's in domestic issues. And as far as foreign policy, you can't be much worse. Like, even if you're the same, it's just like, yeah, it's awful. I mean, you can't be worse than terrible. It's already just, we're funding a colonial massacre. I mean, it's not even, yeah, it's a genocide. It's an old fashioned colonial massacre. It happened in India. It happened in Ireland. It's a colonial massacre of indigenous people. We're paying for it, and it's gross. That's the first part. So I don't know how that's gonna work out. But leaving that aside, I have no problem with really, like, okay, she's the vice president, and now she will be the nominee probably because Biden's too old to run. I'm fine with that, actually. I got no issue with it. My issue comes back to something you said earlier about, like, well, if I make waves while I'm running, people won't work with me, I'll get blackballed. If I make waves once I'm in, people won't work with me, I'll get marginalized, like a Sean Lynn or like a Medina. If I And then, not only that, they'll make it harder for me to win re-election in my district, like sort of the Kerry Harris thing that you were mentioning before. And all I can say to that is, what the fuck are you running for anyway, then? Like, what's the purpose? What are you trying to do?
Why are you doing this? That's literally where I was going with this, with even when we were talking about Eugene. If you can't go in there and make waves, why are you running? Because we're going to end up with the same. We're going to have different faces in the same seats, right? Same. We're going to have the same thing with different faces if we get in there. This is why I say people don't want me to run, because caucus will never dismiss. You're going to hate me.
Like, bring your pillow.
Yes. We're going to be pulling an all-nighter. I'm not backing down. It is what it is. Until it makes sense to me, we're not moving forward. So people say, oh, we need you in there. You don't want me in there. Because I know me. And I know that there's certain things I'm not willing. I've been in situations where I'm the only person and 900 people are disagreeing with me. And I'm going to say loud and proud, I don't care. I said what I said, right? And I get it that everybody's not like that. And I get that, right? I do get that. And, you know, people want to be liked and stuff like that. And luckily, you know, I didn't have that problem growing up. I didn't care if people liked me or not. I was always a new person, so it didn't make a difference. But it's just like, why are we running? I guess that's the thing. When we talk about a why, and why is so important to me, and what I will say that was one of the things that I loved, and you know I got to always do my shout-out to Jess Green. What I loved about Jess was that her why was crystal clear. That when you say, oh, I'm running for the community, what do you mean you're running for the community? If you're going to go in there and do the same thing everybody else is doing in there, right? I'm running because, you know, I want to do X, Y, and Z, and then you get in there, and it's like you do everything but the one X, Y, and Z that you said you were going to do. Right? I think that it's really, why are you running? But I think that also goes back to, we keep asking everybody and their mama to run for office. Then we expect miracles from them, right?
Yeah.
We're asking people to run for office where we don't really know their political views. Like, for example, you know, when George Floyd happened, everybody was on Leibor, right? But then after, all they had to do was say that they support it. We didn't ask the right questions. Supported how? Because technically, if you want to be, there were changes made to Leibor, technically, right? But did we ask them how they support it? How are they going to do it? What were they willing to say? And that's why I said, like, right now, we need to be asking tough questions, and we need to be way more. We have a lot of people who were activists who are running for office now. But are they prepared to get in there and get in that dogfight?
Yeah, this is something that Medina and I talk about quite a bit, and others, about sort of like being prepared for what you're going to kind of step into. Because if you're not prepared, if you're afraid now, you know, if you fear sort of political pressure and you get bullied a little bit and you don't want to make, you know, you don't want to, you know, have a target on your back from the very beginning, then you're probably not going to be any good. Because that's not gonna, because that's gonna continue, and I will say this, I would be remiss not to point out my opinion about this, about people wanting, you know, a politician is going to want to be liked by this person, that person, but really what they want is they don't want to be challenged. They want to say, well, I heard everything, I'm not gonna do, you know, I have news for the politicians that think people like them, they don't. They're fake. They would rather be fake liked and not like just, they would rather people not challenge them and just be fake than anything. So yeah, let's be real clear. And if you think I'm speaking about you, I am speaking about you. Nobody likes you. They use you for political power and you're in their political cabal. And so you can wield power as a little group, and you can bully people, and you can do this and that, and try to work your magic, you know, and all of that. But just know, nobody likes you. Even the people that pretend to like you are just pretending. Okay, I think some people probably know that and just don't care, because they'd rather somebody kiss their ass and be fake than anything else. So that's fine for them. But yeah, I don't see how that fits. Like, I understand politicians just generally are going to be like that, and we kind of have to sort of accept that. I mean, if you're going to put your name out there and run for office, you know, in public like that, you're going to have some sort of like, you're going to have a particular kind of personality where, you know, you're going to be ambitious. You're going to want to, you know, you're a politician. You're going to want a glad hand and keep everything sort of copacetic and all that. I get that. I just, you know, I've been saying this for 5 years on this stupid show. There's just too much sort of fake glad-handing that people are like, oh, that, you know, it's so nice to be the 12 people in Dover that are like, that run everything. Like, okay, I guess, but what, like, to what end?
But what is it? To what end? But what are we getting out of it? And that's the part that aggravates me the most. Now, you have the same people at every freaking table, right? But are we making real sustainable progress? Where's the progress coming besides people getting invited to, you know, outings or being at, you know, hobnobbing with politicians and stuff, right? Where is it? What are we really getting? What is really getting changed?
Oh, nothing. And not only that, I can tell you that the people who are in leadership now do not want anything to change. They like this little balance where people have to come and grovel. You know, you have to come and grovel. You know, will you file this bill? Will you put it in the right committee? Will I come to a floor vote? Will it, did it, you know, it's like they love that. They love people coming in and with on their hands and knees just groveling for scraps. Yeah, it feels good if you're a psychopath. Yeah, I mean, if you're an absolute sort of like if you've been socialized to sort of like not care about that, yeah, I guess you would like people coming in and having to fucking beg you for shit. It's just weird. We don't have to do it like this. Like,
absolutely do not.
We do not.
But how do we change it? But how do we change it? And the reason I say how do we change it is because when we talk about how the things are set up and everything, right? It's like almost like the people, there's only a handful. You know, I came into this organizing scene during COVID. And when I tell you, majority of the people do not know how anything works as far as our government, our local governments. They don't know how bills, like what has to go through for bills to even get to a floor vote. They don't know these things. They don't know how committees are assigned. They don't know how to look up people's voting records, right? So when you're talking about the majority of the people are ignorant to how things work and the processes that go into things, and then those same people are the people who are voting, it's almost like that they have to keep up appearances versus, like, in order, like, literally they're keeping up appearances rather than actually being held accountable.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. Oh, no, I think that's a good way to put it. There, what you call keep up appearances, I just sort of mean like maintain the status quo institutions, because that's, you know, that's where the power comes from. That's what they like. The fact that it doesn't do anything, or the fact that they can win their election because, you know, you sort of have a, you know, it's a moderately interested voter. They know your name. You pick up the phone if they call, or you answer their email. Like, they don't have to do any of that stuff. And they're never going to do it without a real challenge. Not groveling, not begging, not being fake, not you know, letting them speak at an event or inviting them to an event or pretending that they're smart or, you know, whatever. That's not going to work. It hasn't worked. It never works. We take so many fucking L's and we don't just admit that, oh, maybe what we were doing is not effective.
One thing that I will say that I just want to make sure before I forget that I put this out here, Carl, just put it where it belongs. But I think it's really important that people understand that when people don't really care, what I've noticed, voters don't really care about what they're voting when they're in down at Lake Hall. They care about what they're doing in the community. Because when I tell you, they love Carrie Evelyn Harris down in Kent County. They love Bill Bush down in Kent County. You cannot convince anybody that Bill Bush doesn't do his job, because Bill Bush does what the community needs. The same thing with Andrea Bennett. It was the same way. people who may be in the political spheres may have had a problem with her votes or with her lack of things, but people in King County, they loved Andrea because Andrea answered her phone. Andrea showed up for people. Andrea listened to people's concerns. When they needed their road fixed or their light was out, she expressed that she cared about the issues and different things. So I think that that's another part of the problem, is that people who are maybe in more politically connected, they look at like the things that Carrie does or this doesn't vote on or doesn't do, or she's not out here like being loud. But then when you come down to King County and you see what she's done, where she's done things, when she's held all kind of different programs and she's getting really good turnouts and she's showing up to things and she's supporting things and she's, you know, championing things in the community, people care more about that because that they see directly affects them versus what her voting records are or leaderboard. They really, that's where and I think that that's where the disconnect comes between activists and who are more close in proximity to the political aspect and community members. And I think that that's the part where we have to draw balance.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair enough. And I mentioned it before, just, you know, Sarah McBride was my state senator. She was very, you know, with constituent services, right? Like, hey, listen to you, you know, get you a contact in another department if you needed it for something, or... you know, like you said, street lights out, potholes fixed, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's incredibly important at a local level, for sure. But again, I think the disconnect is that people generally think that, oh, so neat, I saw my state senator or my state representative at this meeting, and I talked to them, they listened to me, and that was cool. But, like, they did that. There's an ulterior motive for that, and that's the easy part. Showing up at a thing and talking to everybody, that's not hard. Like, hey, I showed up at a symposium and we can talk about, hey, you know, I'll bring your concerns to the fucking to the legislature, or I'll do this or I'll do that. Yeah, that taking a stand is the hard part. Like actually doing something that'll impact people's lives, not just make them feel good. Like a material change, a material change in people's condition, their health care, their housing, their wages. You know, people need to understand that we should be asking for much, much more. And that's
that part, kind of, I need you to repeat that one more time.
We need to be asking for much, much more.
Thank you. And that's what the problem is. I'm going to tell you one of the things I keep hearing people say. People keep saying, well, what is such and such going to do for Black people? Dude, stop asking people what they're going to do for Black people and start telling them what you want them to do, right? Why do we tell them what you want? So then this way, they can say yay, nay, boo, or, you know, go to hell. But we have to stop saying, well, what are you going to do? Well, I want to know what her platform is. No, we need to say, I'm looking for somebody to champion this. We need police reform. We need X, Y, and Z. We need to start demanding what we want from these people before they're running for office, while they're walking around running for office. We keep letting people come knock on our doors and tell us what they're going to do. But are you telling them what you need done? Are you telling them what you need for your community? When they're coming up there and they're having candidate debates and all these forums and stuff, they ask the same. I can almost tell you what the questions are before they even ask the questions. We ask the same freaking questions every time. People practice their answers and then they go back and do the opposite or nothing at all about what they said, because we ask the same five flimsy questions every single time.
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfect... I watched... a gubernatorial sort of town hall. It was the same night that I actually interviewed Colin O'Mara. But it was exactly like you're saying. It's like, well, what are you going to do for X? And they just go back in their memory bank. I'm going to do A, B, C. Well, you're not really going to do any of that. It's a nice talking point. But you didn't make a demand. We want X.
You didn't say. Our schools are overcrowded. What are you going to do so that we can lower the number of teachers, the student-to-teacher ratio in our district? Like, what is your exact plan for that? Like, how would you do that? Who do you have to support that plan? Like, we need to ask them, not just only because, again, they can't do it. A lot of times it's just them with their one vote, right? Then you can't do it by yourself. So have you talked to other people, your colleagues? What's your relationship with other senators or other representatives in the House or other elected officials in the area? Like, we need to ask better questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is sort of like perfect Delaware Way stuff, like Joe Biden stuff. Like, everybody thinks these people are your friends, and they like to develop and foster that idea that, like, oh, they're very, you know, they pick up the phone and they do this and that, which is fine, but they're doing that because that's their fucking job. And so it's not like people think they have this relationship with these people, like, well, I'm not going to be mean to them because they helped me, you know, get a stop sign put up or change that. Like, that's their fucking job.
Literally.
So it's like
the bar's in hell. So being that they're so used to people not being able to get a hold of them or them not doing something, when somebody actually does their job, even if it's a tiny fraction of their whole job, now you don't put them on a pedestal because they're really here for their community because they fixed the stop sign, put a stop sign where it should have been already.
Well, I wanted to invite you, and I think I copied you on an email, but it's just another way to plug this event. Hanif and I are throwing a rally, Justice for All, at the Clifford Brown Walk in Wilmington, Friday the 23rd of August. We're going to have a lot of speakers, we're going to have live performances, and it's going to be all about people that have been affected by police violence and police misconduct. And it's also going to explain, as we've sort of alluded to in this conversation, that our efforts to address some of these problems have run headlong into the Delaware Way institutions. And we are going to need more people to line up and smash through that. And so we're inviting everybody out to come. There's going to be food and drink. There's going to be a show. And it's just going to be sort of a fun way to hang out in the park and learn more about sort of people's experiences and also what we can do to start making some reforms. It's about accountability, credibility, and transparency, ACT. And it's going to give you ways to act next session and even before that to get some change in police misconduct and police reform. So, Ty, thank you so much. I hope to see you very soon. I was sorry to miss the network event in Dover because of my medical issues, but I know it was a super event, and I'll be at the next one.
Yes, and we understand. And Kirsten, shout out to Kirsten at Network Delaware. Kirsten Walter did an amazing job once again. The second annual Social Change Summit.
Yeah. Incredible work from her, as always, really. And she's also not going to stop. There's going to be more organizing this fall. And there's going to be another summit next year because we're just going to grow this. We're just going to grow this effort. And part of it is to just simply show up for people and show solidarity and show people that you're not afraid. Because I'm not afraid. And I know fucking Ty Greer's not afraid.
Not afraid. We got this.
I also know something else. Left is best.